ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome back to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of your hosts, Hal Bryan, EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications. And over there to my right, it is...
Tom Charpentier, government relations director.
Welcome, Tom. You and I haven't done one of these in a little while. It's good to reconnect.
I don't think I've done a podcast in general in quite a while. It just hasn't matched up with my schedule, I guess, but...
Well, that's the beauty of having some rotating hosts, but... I'm just going to bet that of all the people out there listening, like 99% of them aren't here to hear us. So just putting that out there.
Yeah, fair enough.
We are really, really lucky and privileged, in fact, to have a terrific guest right here in the studio with us today. He's a pilot that all but needs no introduction. If you've been to an air show, you've seen an artist at work, and that is Matt Youngkin. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's really good to have you back, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. You and I've crossed paths several times over the years and worked on some stories together, and I'm glad that our listeners get a chance to get to know you a little bit. Who's the man behind the Twin Beach?
Yes, sir. Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. So, Matt, let's start at the beginning. Your story is certainly somewhat known out there, but for those that don't know you, tell us a bit about your background, your early aviation memories, and let's go from there.
Well, I don't know how far back you want to go.
Well, let's see, somewhere after the dinosaurs, but...
fair enough. Well, so I'm a third generation aviator. My grandfather and both of his brothers were pilots, and my dad was a on-demand freight and charter pilot and a renowned air show pilot as well. And after his passing in 2005, I kind of picked up the reins to the family business and ran with it. And we're still doing it today. So I learned to fly when I was 14 in a Piper Cub from a family friend. And closer to my 16th birthday, the same instructor that taught my dad to fly refined my piloting skills. And I soloed my grandfather's 1928 Travelair 4000 biplane on my 16th birthday.
Wow.
And it was 19 degrees outside on January 7th, and I bundled up and every bit of clothes I had, and we made it work. For me, that's cold. I know we're in Oshkosh in February, and people are listening to this going, oh, you're just a wuss, but well, in an open cockpit biplane in Arkansas in January, that's pretty cold.
That is pretty cold. And it was 50 degrees here a few days ago as we're recording this. So who knows what it's going to do or what it's going to be. That's one of the cooler, you have one of the cooler solo stories I've ever heard of, soloing a Travelair on your 16th birthday. I mean, that's, you're not the type, but for most people, that'd be some serious bragging rights.
Well, it was pretty neat. It's an incredible airplane. I still have it to this day. My grandpa since passed on, and I ended up with that airplane. And my grandkids are going to have to figure out what to do with it because it's never leaving the family as long as I'm around.
You're here now. What was the first nose wheel airplane you flew?
That's a good question. I'd say probably a Cessna 150. Because I did some of my primary instruction in that as well.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering about that.
That was after my solo.
Right. So, and what a great way to do it. I mean, there's a segment of people out there who will roll their eyes and call me a boomer or something else and stuff for saying that. But I personally think anybody who has the opportunity to do some tailwheel training and ideally first, comes out ahead.
I agree with that. It is possible to go back and learn that skill afterwards, but it's kind of like when you learn to drive. If you use a clutch before you ever get behind the wheel of an automatic transmission vehicle, you're a lot better off.
And Hal, as a millennial, I would endorse that sentiment, so you're good.
Oh, thank goodness for that. And technically, I'm an old Gen Xer, not a young boomer, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah. So where did your progression go from there? I know your family was very steeped in the business, so I'd imagine that you kind of came up through that. How did your early career start?
Well, you know, my aspirations from a young kid was to fly for the airlines. You know, that was always kind of the goal. It's kind of most everybody's goal that, you know, that learns to fly, that wants to do it for a living. You know, none of us really have any imagination to figure out what to do that's not flying for the airlines, because that's what you hear about all the time. So that was my plan. I got my ratings as I was growing up. And anyway, when I was old enough and had enough time to fly for the airlines weren't hiring. So I, you know, did some jobs around Northwest Arkansas. And then in 2005, when my dad passed away, there was an immediate financial need to try to repay some of the deposits that he had taken on the following season for the air shows he was no longer able to fulfill. And one thing led to another, and I found it was easier for me to do that in an airplane than it was to come up with other means of making that work. So that's how I started in the air show industry. It's not something I ever aspired to do, and you know, I did it you know, like as a family obligation, if you will, and also to honor the memory of my father. And one thing led to another, and I'm still here doing it today.
Wow. That's amazing. As you said, nearly 20 years on. Now, you know, Matt, the circumstances in which you lost your father are well known and tragic and rather public. Was there ever a moment where you had to really stop and think? Were you ever hesitant to say maybe I need to go in a different direction because of how he was lost? Or you mentioned honoring him, which leads me to think, you know, you got committed once you did. But
well, you know, it's yes and no. You know, it's all of the above. And you know, I do have another job that has become my primary job that I'm really enjoying, flying a corporate jet for a local company in Northwest Arkansas. So I have scaled back the air show side of the house quite a bit, but I plan on continuing to fly air shows, at least for the foreseeable future. So as far as what you're getting at was the type of flying that he was doing when he passed away is not the type of flying I do. So in that realm, I have taken my air show career a different direction. You know, the Beech-18 was always the airplane that he was known for. And of course, it's, you know, our family story goes back generations around the Twin Beach. So, that in itself is a sentimental thing. And, that's kind of where my career ended up and, where I plan to keep it.
Let's, talk a little bit more about your family history with the type. Because that's something that you and I, as I mentioned, we worked on a story about that together a while ago. But let people know how is the Beech-18, you know, beyond the beautiful red and black one that we know you for, how does that airplane fit into the family history?
Well, it goes clear back to World War II. My grandpa's brother Bob, my great uncle, taught multi-engine transition training in Beech-18s for the Department of the Navy during the war. And even after the war, all of the World War II Twin Beaches were basically the same airframe with slight modifications, you know, for bombardier training versus navigator training versus VIP transport. It didn't matter whether it was an Army or Navy airplane or one of the airplanes, you know, sold to the Commonwealth or on the Lend-Lease program. They were all basically the same airframe, which is the same airplane that I do air shows in. My red and black airplane was an AT-7 Navigator for the Army Air Corps during World War II.
Oh, wow.
And unlike the majority of the other Twin Beaches, my airplane never went back to Wichita and was remanufactured into the later D model. So what they did, Beechcraft came up with this incredible plan to, instead of selling the government a fleet of brand new Twin Beaches that were more capable of the mission at hand, they took back all of the World War II surplus airplanes and remanufactured them and then sent them back out into the field. So they changed the incidence in the tail, they lengthened the nacelles, they changed the aspect ratio of the wing between the fuselage and the engines, they put a stronger gear under them, a stronger spar, and just made a whole bunch of different modifications that If you know what you're looking for, are easy to spot on an air show ramp. But if you don't, that airplane looks very similar to mine, but they're not the same airplane. So long story short, my Uncle Bob flew the first airplane that was scheduled to have that modification done. I believe it was from Corpus Christi, Texas, at the Naval Air Station to Wichita, and dropped it off. And 6 weeks later, he went back and picked it up and brought it back to the base. And he said they ruined it. Said it never did fly right after that. So, and there's some truth to that. You know, all Beach 18s fly phenomenally, but the C model flies way different than the later model airplanes. So, fast forward several generations, my dad had fallen in love with a Twin Beach as a young kid because my grandfather was working at Mitchell Industries designing autopilots for Century, well, what became Century Flight Systems in the 1960s. And they had Beach 18s come into the service center there to have autopilot installations done. And my dad saw that airplane for the first time and thought that was the neatest looking airplane he'd ever seen and fell in love with it then. And later on, when he met my mother, they went out on their first date to the local drive-in to get a milkshake and then down to the Fayetteville Airport to watch the greasy, oily Twin Beach mail plane start up and take off into the night. And for some reason or other, after that, she still ended up marrying him. And they moved to South Dakota, where he took on his first flying job as an airmail pilot flying Twin Beaches. And he did that again. He did that for 6 months until the contract dried up. And then he moved to Malden, Missouri and did the same thing. And then moved back to Arkansas, where they were originally from, and took out a loan and bought a Twin Beach of his own and started flying on-demand freight in that airplane. And that and some of the other ones he had over the years, he hauled freight in Twin Beaches till I graduated high school. So the air show thing came about. He was already a renowned air show pilot with his T6 routine that he'd been doing since about the same time, in 82 or 83 is when he started that. He said that in the 1980s, they didn't really enforce duty time. So if you could stay up for days on end flying back and forth, you could make an awful lot of money hauling freight. But he said after about day three of no sleep, he'd get delirious and he'd have these crazy ideas, you know, that seemed like a good idea at the time. But, you know, when he'd get a good night's sleep, he'd wake up the next morning going, what in the hell was I thinking? But the one and only idea that came up around that time in the evening that he couldn't sleep off was doing an aerobatic demonstration in a Twin Beach. It still seemed like a good idea the next morning. So anyway, my grandpa and his brother Bob acquired a C model Twin Beach as basically a retirement airplane for the old men to just play with, because Bob had talked for years about what a wonderful airplane that was. And so they brought this thing home and they had Dad fly it home from them, and he admired the fact that it was lighter and faster than all of the freighters he'd ever flown. And anyway, one thing led to another, and in 1988 he did his first air show in that airplane. And all these years later, I'm continuing that legacy.
Now, were there modifications made to sort of to prepare the airplane? Was there anything? Obviously, you've got the lights and the air show smoke. Anything structural done to sort of reinforce the airframe?
No, it's got the same spar strap on it that all of the other Twin Beaches that are flyable are required to have. Other than that, there's nothing. There's nothing new and different about this airplane. We stripped everything out of it that it didn't need to do the mission at hand, you know, to keep it light. But over the years, she's gotten older and fatter just like I have. So, you know, we've put upgraded Cleveland wheels and brakes on it to make it more capable, but they're also very heavy. And, of course, we've made some avionics upgrades and put an autopilot in it. And, of course, all of the lights and the wiring that makes all those lights work, it weighs plenty as well. So airplanes, she's still quite capable, but just not quite as capable as she used to be.
So when you, obviously this routine had been going on for quite a while before you took it over. Had you been flying it at all before you started doing it full time, or did it take some time to learn and develop for you before you went back out on the air show scene?
Well, actually, I'd never flown the airplane before in my life.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's a whole nother story. I grew up flying model airplanes, so I had a concept of how aerobatics worked. And Dad and I went out in the Super Decathlon a couple of times and worked on slow rolls. And anyway, I understood the concept, but I couldn't make my feet do what needed done to get that slow roll accomplished. And both times we went out, by the time we got back to the airport, he was pretty irritated with me because he'd explained it and I'd tried to do it and I got my left foot to work. But when it came for my time for my right foot to do something, it just locked up and wouldn't work. And so we went back to the airport, and that was kind of the end of that. And anyway, after he passed away, we started thinking about continuing on, you know, as a family. Amanda and Kyle and I, all three, were, you know, trying to figure out what to do next. And anyway, I thought, well, I should go out and get in this airplane and see what I could do. And I got in the front seat and felt a little cramped. And then I realized my dad was 4 inches shorter than I am. And I reached down and grabbed a lever, and the seat moved back several inches, and all of a sudden I had leg room. And I went out over the lake and attempted a slow roll, and both of my feet worked because my legs had room to operate. And anyway, with that knowledge in mind, you know, and that ability to actually exercise, you know, my legs in the airplane, I was able to teach myself aerobatics. And I did my first show in that airplane, you know, 5 months after he passed away.
Wow.
So to answer your question, that's the long answer. I had ridden in the Twin Beach growing up an awful lot, but the only time I ever had the opportunity to fly one, he put me in the left seat of an airplane that he was giving somebody else instruction in. I just kind of weaseled my way in for one go around, and the takeoff was great. And I came in to land, and I had never flown anything that sat that high up off the ground before.
Oh boy.
So I was just starting to feel for the gear when we crashed. And anyway, he gathered it up and got it back in the air and set it back down on the mains like it was supposed to be, and then gave it to me for the rollout, which I did fine at. But he was not happy, and I didn't get the opportunity to redeem myself. So we taxied back in, and he kicked me out and went ahead on with the instruction that he was doing with the other guy. So the next time I flew a Twin Beach from the left seat was the red and black airplane, and that was over a year after he passed away. So I not only had to learn how to fly the airplane and get checked out in it, but then I had to figure out how to do aerobatics in it. And that's a lot different than doing aerobatics in a Super Decathlon. So I actually used old air show footage that we had to figure that out, you know, with a calculator and a stopwatch and, you know, a notepad. You know, Amanda was able to call several of the shows that he had flown the year before and find out how much fuel and smoke oil he took on after each performance. And so we were able to duplicate the weight and balance of the airplane. With that information in hand, I'd start the VCR. Like, for example, when he would line the airplane up on the runway and start rolling, I'd start the stopwatch. And when he'd get it airborne and suck the gear up, I'd make a mark on the paper, like how long that took. And then when he would fly it in ground effect and you could see the airplane start to pitch up to do the roll-on takeoff, that's when I'd stop the watch. And I had my entry speed for the roll-on takeoff by duplicating the weight and balance of the airplane and lining it up on a nice summer day and going and doing it myself. So anyway, that's the way I basically pieced together his entire Twin Beach routine.
That's incredible. So there were really no notes that you had or anything written down about how that routine worked?
No, I'd seen it 100 times.
Yeah.
So, and anyway, I had flown in the airplane cross country with him before, but we'd never, I think he, when I was a kid, my buddy and I were in the back seat and he buzzed the house and pitched up and rolled it like you shouldn't have done with, you know, two brats in the back, but that was the only time I'd ever been upside down at a Twin Beach. So it was new and different, that's for sure.
Wow.
Yeah, that really is amazing, because it would be as an outsider, a spectator and a fan, which I am, I make no bones about that. It would be easy to sort of assume that, you know, before his loss, Dad would have passed this on to you. And that's, you know, that seems like that's just a story that would make sense, that well, he did it, and at some point he taught you, and then you picked it up. So the fact that you had to just piece it together is remarkable. And I think there's another interesting lesson here. Like, anybody who's seen you perform, in my mind, Matt, you're one of those just universal constants at an air show that we watch you perform, and you know, I've never seen a hiccup. You know, you count on you to do this beautiful show, and everything from the crowd side, everything just looks perfect. And not just blowing smoke over here, but interesting to then try to take that person that we see on the big stage and then imagine him struggling to finish to get a slow roll right in the decathlon, or then having to sort of teach yourself these things. And anything, I mean, you mentioned the moving the seat and the decathlon, of course, but otherwise it's just practice, right?
Well, it is. And you know, the way I came up and got to where I ended up with the aerobatics and the air show career, that's not something I would recommend for anybody else. You know, formal instruction is a good thing. And there are schools out there where you can go and you can learn the basics with somebody in the back seat that'll keep you out of trouble, because it's really easy to get in trouble trying to figure some of this stuff out on your own. So don't do as I did, do as I say is kind of where I would go with that. But it worked for me, but it doesn't work for everybody.
So obviously you were talking about what you've just been describing was picking up the day show and moving ahead with it. But the night show is a completely different creation that you've developed. What was that like to come up with a routine that you could do at night, that you had all the reference points you needed in the dark, and then of course, you know, putting it to music and having all the lights and the smoke and all that?
Well, there's, you know, two rules of thumb for developing an air show act. And the first one was one that Dad preached. He said, take off, do what you're good at once, and land. You know, keep it short and sweet. And the Twin Beach only does three or four maneuvers. And, you know, if you do them all three or four times, people are going to the funnel cake stand because they've already seen it twice, you know. So that was rule number one for the night show. The other thing I've always believed is an air show act, to be successful, it needs to be unique. And in addition to the showcasing the aircraft, you've got to have good music and a good script for a good announcer to read. So if you're missing any of those pieces, it detracts from the total package that you're trying to display for the crowd. So the soundtrack and the narration for the night show was as important as the flying and the lights, in my opinion. But the way it all started for us, you know, the Twin Beach day show was designed to be very much a tribute. It's not exactly Dad's sequence, but it's pretty close. I changed a couple of little things and added a couple of things that he did when he was first starting that he wasn't doing towards the end, because I thought they were neat. And anyway, so that was kind of scripted to be what it was. The night show was, you know, Jeff and I, my crew chief, we were sitting around the hangar one evening and looking at that airplane, and it still had all of the military lights on it, just none of them worked. You know, it had formation lights top and bottom, and it had the passing light and the leading edge of the left wing, and the IFF lights, you know, or color of the daylights, if you will, that you see on all the warbirds, red, green, and amber, they weren't on the airplane anymore, but the plates were. There were plates where they used to be. And, of course, it had great big landing lights that didn't work, and taxi lights in the nose that didn't work. And I told Jeff, you know, if all the lights that this airplane left the factory with, if they all worked, we'd be halfway to a pretty decent night show. And he agreed with me, and we started talking about it. And when I was growing up, there were very few people that did night shows. I remember Gene Susi and Steve Oliver and Bill Leff were kind of the three that you could, if you saw a night show, it was one of them. And then I think Julie Clark started doing it a little bit later on, but that was the entire night show lineup, period. And then I saw Aeroshell do a twilight show later in years. And of course, after, you know, once AeroShell flies, everybody else might as well go home, because that's just that's the end of it. They're as good as it gets, especially at dusk. So anyway, I've always thought night shows were really neat. And we got a hold of Wheeland Aviation Engineering, or Wheeland Engineering, and then eventually Lopresti Boom Beam Lights, and they basically gave us a blank slate, and they said, if it works on your airplane or you think you might have a room spot for it, send us a list. We'll mail it to you, and whatever you don't use, just mail it back. And so we started plugging and playing, and the concept I wanted to come up with, of course, you got to start with the smoke lights, because those are cool. You know, it makes the smoke look like it's on fire, and that's something everybody else was doing. And, the neat thing about the Twin Beach is I can put four smoke lights on it instead of just the, two or the single one behind the engine like all the other guys do, because I've got those big vertical tails out there that I can bolt a light to. And so that was... that airplane it'll light up the smoke a long ways back, better than a lot of the other ones out there. So that was where we started. But I wanted the airplane to have a stark contrast. I wanted the top of it to be lit up planned form, where it looks like the whole, you can see the entire airframe and it's glowing in the dark. And and then the bottom of it was where we put the strobes, so it would twinkle. So it's when the airplane is coming through and it's doing a rolling maneuver or a pass, the crowd, it's very obvious to the spectators which side of the airplane they're looking at as it's going by. And the other thing for me is that if you put all the twinkly stuff on the bottom, I don't have to look at it while I'm flying, because I can't see it. So there's a safety measure built in there as well. So that's where we started. And I already had some music in mind. And I put together a soundtrack and put together a script, and Amanda and I got to work, doing the choreography for this. And it all worked. And back in the day when she was helping me with it, she was really good. She had a musical ear, and she could tell me precisely when to, or I'd tell her when to start the second track after we took off. And she would tell me when the first song had finished and when we're halfway through the second song, and, when to turn this set of lights on, and we're coming up on the big push on the last one. All right, down on the deck now, like for the final pass. All right, pitch and pull, wait for it, lights out. And Amanda was calling all that stuff to me over the radio, and she actually was able to choreograph the show from the ground, and all I had to do was fly the airplane. So that's the way we started when we started flying this routine. Of course, after Amanda passed away, I found it was easier for me to just listen to the music through the headset than it was to try to train somebody else to give all of those verbal cues that she came up with on her own. So to this day, I actually listen to the music in the airplane while I'm flying the sequence, and I throw the toggle switches and rotary dials accordingly to make every pass look just a little bit different than the last one. And like I said earlier, when I run out of maneuvers to do and run out of light switches to flip, it's time to quit.
Before the music stops.
Exactly.
I just have to ask, where did the idea for the very first part of your act come from? The basically the rocket liftoff and then cutting the lights.
Well, I've always been a big fan of all sorts of music, but I remember I had a classical thunder CD growing up that had the 2001 Space Odyssey on it. And, I'd listen to that growing up. And when I was imagining how this act would work, of course, at night, you can't do a roll on takeoff, and everybody else was doing an air start. And I thought, well, how cool would it be to have some kind of a presence in front of the crowd where this airplane just looks mean and, like it's ready to go do something cool, and then turn that into some kind of a launch sequence, if you will, that's cool until the end. And we went out and played with it. And, for a Beach 18, this one climbs like a homesick angel.
Yeah.
Most of them don't. This airplane, it's especially when it's light, like for when we fly air shows with it goes upstairs. So it worked just well enough to make that takeoff sequence work. And the other neat part about that is, for me, you know, the break in between is it's necessary to build the energy and come back in and start the next part of the sequence. But it also gave me an opportunity to build a little bit of a thank you in there to our active duty military and veterans, and also to all of the salty old freight and mail pilots that cut their teeth on these airplanes back in the day.
Yeah.
Because like I told you before, that part of aviation is very important to me, because I was raised by somebody that was part of that group. So that's what we do during the break, and then dive back in. And hopefully when Phantom of the Opera starts and the lights come on, it gives people goosebumps, because that was the effect that we were going for.
That certainly does.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And, you know, the air shows are, you know, such a big part of Air Venture, our big annual convention, but it's, you know, it is just one part of it. And, you know, you go year after year after year, and there's acts that you can enjoy, but you know what, maybe I've seen this before and I've got something else I've got to go and do. But you're on that very short list, and I know a lot of people would agree who, whatever they're doing, when you fly, they stop.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate that.
And that's no disrespect to any of the other performers. It's just, as you well know, Air Venture, there's a lot going on. There's a million things you could be doing at any one time. And, you know, it's not strictly a traditional air show, but like I said, you're one of the, you're one of the crowd stoppers. I was going to ask, if it's not too personal, do you have any little superstitions, any little rituals, anything you do before a performance? And if it's too personal, then we'll just move on.
I wouldn't say superstitions, but I have rituals. There are certain things that we do that, I don't know. I wouldn't say settles the nerves or puts the mind at ease. It's just, it's part of the package deal. It's like part of the checklist, if you will.
Sure.
Like, for example, when I line up on the runway, I always, say a prayer. I ask the good Lord above to get me through this performance. And when I'm taxiing in, right before I shut the engines down, I say another one and thank him for the good performance.
That's wonderful.
That's who I am, and it works for me. And, we have a good relationship as a result of that. I think he's taken care of me up to this far. You know, another thing is the last person that I see at an air show when he's able to attend, which is 90% of the time, is Jeff, my crew chief. You know, in the night show, he actually has to button me into the cockpit, because we put a shower curtain up that goes between the cockpit and the cabin to block out all of the ambient light that's coming from those lights that are looking through the windows. Sure. So he has to... You know, it's Velcroed in, so I can get through it and get out in a hurry if I need to, but I can't put it on myself, so he has to do that. But even for the day shows, I always get in, and he's the last person that shuts the door, and he says, Matt, fly safe and have fun, and I'll see you on the radio, you know, and
that's great.
That's just the way it is. And then Jeff is always the one that starts me. He'll move out front, make sure the chocks are out of the way, and, you know, clears me to start the engines. You know, whether or not there's somebody else there whose job it's supposed to be to do that, Jeff's always the one that does it. So it's, you know, little things like that. And, when my wife and kids are there, you know, I salute Jeff when I'm ready to taxi out, and they'll be off at the wingtip, and I'll blow her a kiss and she blows me one back, and the kids wave. Yeah, just little stuff like that. And, you know, obviously, you know, every show's just a little bit different, but little constant things like that are just, it's part of our ritual, if you will.
Right. Like how you said, it's almost like a checklist. It's just part of these are the steps to go through to get, you know, to get yourself ready, get the airplane ready. It's all just an extension.
Yes, sir. Right.
You've mentioned, the freight background and that being part of your family and things. Now, a few years ago, you showed up here with two Beach 18s. And in fact, we put them on the cover of Sport Aviation. Can you tell us about the white one?
So the white airplane is very near and dear to my heart. You know, I grew up with that airplane. He bought that airplane in 1982, the year after I was born, and that was the one that he kept and hauled freight in until I graduated high school. My father, of course. And there was other Twin Beaches that came and went. He would have one on a scheduled run sometimes with another pilot, or he would buy and sell and horse trade them. There was always the, later in years, there was the air show beach that was always in the back of the hangar. But that white airplane, I can say about 80% of my memories in aviation growing up had that airplane in them somewhere. And if it wasn't the focal point, it was just in the background while something else cool was going on. That airplane was always there. And anyway, many years later, I knew where the airplane ended up. And a friend of mine out in Kansas had acquired it from the guy my dad sold it to. And it had sat there for a long time. He had taken it apart and was planning on restoring it and making it perfect. And, you know, it just, life gets in the way, and the putting back together process never really happened. But I dropped out of the sky one day, coming home from another air show out west to get fuel. And, well, my real mission was to go look at 18RY again, because I hadn't seen it in a decade. And he took me over to the hangar and showed me the airplane. And I'm walking around it, and I looked inside. And of course, it's all been gutted. And I said, "Well, do you still have the interior? Do you still have the seats?" He's like, "Oh yeah, yeah, they'll be in the will. Don't you worry about it." So the running joke for years was that when he got done with the airplane, he was going to will it to me. And I had no intention of ever needing that airplane back anytime soon. I just thought, you know, many years from now, if I was ever going to have another Twin Beach, or if I was ever going to keep just one Twin Beach to pass down to my kids, I would want it to be the airplane I grew up with, you know. And of course, 2020 happened, and the 23 shows I booked turned into 3 shows that actually happened. And in October of that year, I get a text from my friend saying, "Hey, you need to come get this airplane. My situation's changed. Come out here. Let's make a deal on it, or I'm going to put it on trade-a-plane and get rid of it." So what a horrible year to have to come up with some money to buy an airplane you don't need.
No kidding.
So one thing led to another, and I mean, it was a big moral struggle. How do you justify? I mean, I'm having a hard time feeding one Twin Beach. How do I justify another one, you know, that where there's really no mission for it to provide, you know, pay its way in any way, shape, or form at this point? But anyway, I talked it over with my wife, and she was very gracious about, she's like, "Well, if you need to do this, I understand. I'm not excited about it, but, you know, you do what you need to do," which sometimes is code for don't do it. But in this case, I think she meant well. So anyway, we made a deal on the airplane, and the bill of sale was signed on October 30th, 2020, which would have been my dad's 65th birthday.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know how much time do we have here. I could go on and on about this.
we're getting close to the end of the episode. Okay. But
well, anyway, I took Jeff out there because I told him, I said, "Well, you know, it hadn't flown in 18 years, but I think if we put some fresh gas in it and bolt the pilot seats and the rudder pedals back in, we could probably get it home in a weekend, you know, and do, the flaps need to go back on it too, you know, that
just real quick."
Yeah. But it doesn't need gear doors to fly home, and, you know, all the interior stuff. We could just get a ferry permit. We get it home. It won't be that big a deal. And I took him out there and showed him in the airplane. He walks around, he goes, "Matt, what in the hell have you gotten us into?" And anyway, 4 different trips or 5 different trips, and almost 3 weeks, well, a little over 3 weeks later, you know, staying there and working on this thing, we were able to get it home. And then there was another couple of months worth of work to get it ready to come to Oshkosh. And one thing I'd touched on earlier was about the freight pilots that would come up to me and tell me their stories when they would see me fly at a night show. In addition to being raised by one and being on the same airport where there was another freight operator that had 5 Beech 18s and several 400 series Cessnas that would go off into the night. I mean, it was just all around. I got to go on the runs when the weather was nice. It was just a neat part of growing up for me. But I'd read this during the night show sequence, read the tribute to the freight pilots in between the takeoff sequence and the rest. And when I had the airplane back, it occurred to me I need to put the cargo liner back in this and use the cot and the thermoses and the tie-down chains and all of the stuff that, that this airplane left with when it was making a living that I still had and bring it to Oshkosh and try to get some folks to look at it and bring stir up some memories that we could put on what we ended up doing was a YouTube channel for it. And that's still a mission we're trying to continue today. I just get as many stories as I can, put them on the channel so that the kids and the grandkids of these old freight pilots can see what their relatives actually did for a living back in the day when they were trying to build time to go do something better.
And we can make sure to put a link to that channel on the page when this episode goes up. I will ask my stalwart production coordinator to who is listening right now, who will to help me remember that. And by help me, I mean she'll remember and I won't. But for people who are just listening right now, Matt, is there a quick way to find the YouTube channel?
Yeah, so it's if you go to my website, yunkinair.com, there's a link on there that goes to the Freight Dog Files, I think is what we've called the YouTube channel. And there's information about 18RY, that airplane I was telling you about on there. So if you click on that, the button that goes to that page, it has a link to the YouTube channel.
Perfect. Oh, that's great. One other thing I wanted to ask you about that that airplane, and I think I know the answer to this, but what would you say was perhaps the most unusual thing that that your dad ever carried in that airplane, or at least in one of the freight BH-18s?
Well, there's no telling what he carried that I don't remember or never heard about, but I do know that that airplane carried dolphins in it on more than one occasion.
It's just so hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah. He came to the Springdale airport one time. He called the line boy, you know, about 15 miles out and said, I need you to go to the gas station and buy every bag of ice they have, you know, and the guy comes back, Bobby, do what? Says, I'll explain when I get there. And he showed up with two dolphins in the back of this airplane that were on tarps, and the trainer was there spraying them down. And anyway, they filled the airplane full of ice and off it went to Oklahoma City where he dropped these dolphins off. And I didn't know when I was a kid, we actually drove to Oklahoma City in the family Suburban and went to the aquarium and saw dolphins do incredible things. I'd never seen a dolphin perform before. I didn't know until after I had bought this airplane and was talking to my mother about it, that the dolphins we saw performing actually arrived in that airpline from Orlando, where they came from. And then the fella that was the line boy at the time actually has a hangar across the ramp from mine in Siloam Springs. And he was the one that told me the story. And he said that for about a week after that, this airplane was parked out on the corner of Dad's ramp as far from the hangar as you could possibly get, with the doors and all the windows open, and had fans blowing at it from every different direction trying to get that dolphin smell out of it.
I don't know if that's ever happened in the history of general aviation. It's like, you know, how do you get the dolphin smell out of an airplane? I don't know if anybody's ever asked that question.
Well, there's probably some folks out there still that have the answer. You never know.
Well, Matt, thanks for joining us. It's really, really interesting to hear the story of how your air show career, you know, has come along, and you know, all of us, you know, folks who have seen you perform all these years, you know, the night show at Oshkosh is, I always tell people that's the unmissable part of Oshkosh. If you're gonna come on Wednesday or Saturday so you can see the night show, and we always know it's not fireworks time until Matt's flown. So,
well, I appreciate
yeah.
that.
Yeah,
it's funny too, trying to get across to people who are maybe new to aviation, who've never been to an air show before, how remarkable it is to see a BH-18 doing all of that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, I get all worked up about it. I mean, like grabbing people by the collar and saying, look, it's like you went to the Indy 500 and a 72 Buick station wagon won. This makes no sense. This airplane shouldn't be doing this. You have no idea the skill it takes to make, yeah. you know, make this airplane, you know, do these loops and rolls and things like that. But it's, it always makes such an impact. So, my gosh, thank you for what you've brought to Oshkosh, and other venues for so long, for continuing that family business. You know, thank you for the chance we had to work on to share the freight dog story.
And I was just going to say, yeah, thank you so much for keeping that history alive. That's such an underrepresented, underappreciated part of general aviation that continues to this day, that we just, you know, don't really hear too many stories about. So thanks for keeping that part of our history alive.
And the stories that are out there, the freight dog stories, you know, they'll raise the hair on the back of your neck and then some.
Oh, that's for sure. You wouldn't believe some of the stories that we've collected on our channel. Some of them will, they'll give you goosebumps, like you said. Others of them are extremely funny. So I would encourage everybody to get on there and check it out.
And Tom on our advocacy team, who champions a lot of our safety efforts, will just weep quietly as he hears some of these stories, I'm sure.
It's the way it is.
It is, yes, or the way it was in some ways, but in some ways still the way it is.
Yep. That's true. I know that several of the folks have started the story by saying, I hope the statute of limitations has run out on this particular event.
Gosh.
So, yes, sir.
Well, on that note, I can think of no better way to bring this episode around and to a close. So, Matt, once again, thank you so much for coming to join us on the show. Again, as we're recording this, you were here at our museum speaking last night, and so thank you so much for that. I'm assuming we're going to see you back here in 5 months?
Yes, sir. I'm planning on being here in July. It's going to be a good time. Looking forward to it.
We are, too. That's for sure. It's always a pleasure. Thanks, as always, to everyone out there for listening. Thanks to everybody who takes the time to send us some feedback, which you can do at by email at feedback@ea.org. If you go over to inspire.ea.org, that's our blog, and every episode there has a landing page. And there's a comment section down below. We look at that stuff and greatly appreciate it. And we would ask anyone out there listening who's enjoyed the show or has some constructive feedback, please leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you're consuming this. Those reviews and that feedback are the only reason we're able to continue doing the show, and have been now for, I think we're coming up on 6 years, 7 years, several years. Anyway, I have no concept of time, but we've been around for a while.
You know what, Hal? I think it's eight.
Is it eight?
I think it was winter of 2016 we started this.
Man. And again, that's all thanks to everybody out there listening. So with our ongoing gratitude, thanks everybody again. Send that feedback, leave those reviews, and we'll look forward to catching up with you next time when you're cleared to land on the green dot.